Hello and welcome to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Stride, and Men's Magazines focuses on the arts, culture, commentary, and in-depth news reporting is found in both the domestic and the international editions of GQ, Esquire, and Men's Health. In this edition, for the second week of April 2024, we will be reading a series of articles inspired by my son, Tristan. Tristan is a fan of vintage Carhartt gear, and vintage clothing is having its moment in the world of high fashion, inspiring cutting-edge couture runway shows and blowing up in social media. Back in the day, us Hepcats would seek out vintage shops on the prowl for a snappy classic deal. Nowadays, every rocker, hip-hopper, and influencer around who freaks for their fits is giving us a run for our money. Phoenix has a dozen or more cool and well-curated vintage boutiques. This week's show offers coaching on how to find and compete for that rare Armani suit or Carhartt Duck Detroit jacket, and how to build a foundation of sartorial staples you can mix and match to make yourself shine. We will begin with GQ and how to shop fashion's vintage boom, then move to Esquire and Esquire UK for What is American Style and Building Blocks for a piece on statement staples. We will conclude with articles from GQ and Men's Health on fashion denim, blue jeans with moves, as time allows. Before we begin, I should mention that Men's Magazines includes adult content and, on occasion, language which some might find offensive. And having said that, I encourage you to sit back, relax, and enjoy Men's Magazines. It's the inspo behind your favorite designer's latest runway show, and the fuel for every TikTok-born core on your feed, which explains why everyone's suddenly hunting for vintage clothing. Here's our guide to digging through the sprawling world of secondhand style like a pro and finding some new-to-you gems of your own. How to Shop Fashion's Vintage Boom by Samuel Hine. In 2017, Colin James Weber and Brandon Valoria Giordano opened a vintage store in the most unassuming retail spot in New York City, on the dim second floor of the East Broadway Mall, a humble building hidden under the Manhattan Bridge in Chinatown. Their shop, James Valoria, would sell archival fashion by legends of the 80s and 90s, like Jean-Paul Gaultier and Vivienne Westwood. The more eccentric and colorful the piece, the better. At first, their ambitions were modest. "Let's just go for it and see what happens. A few people will come, maybe," says Giordano of the opening. For a few years, they were a word-of-mouth spot and knew just about everybody who came in by 1 or 2 degrees, says Weber. And then one day, in the summer of 2020, they found a line for the store snaking through the hallway. "I remember coming in and being like, 'What's wrong with these people? What are they doing?'" recalls Giordano. They found out the shoppers had been waiting for over an hour to get in the door thanks to a TikTok video. That level of buzz carried over to the new wave of vintage stores that soon opened elsewhere in the area, like the Merchy Leisure Center, the 90s subculture specialists at Lara Collegi, archival luxury destination Desert Vintage, and the Street Rack, run by vintage dealer Chad Senzel, a guerrilla closet sale that brought crowds to the corner of Ludlow and Canal Streets, leaving New Yorkers to try on secondhand Ralph Lauren pants right on the busy sidewalk. Welcome to fashion's new preoccupation with the old, fueled by a customer highly attuned to ephemeral trends and stoked by social media. Vintage is now a cultural force that defines how we dress and shop. What was once synonymous with attic-scented Americana is now a remarkably universal obsession shared by downtown scenesters, blue-collar workers, young Hollywood stars, and rappers alike. Even if you don't buy vintage yourself, you're probably still wearing it because more than ever, it influences how new clothing is designed. It's also caught in an awkward phase. Buying vintage remains the most sustainable counterpoint to fast fashion, but it runs the risk of evolving into something shamefully exclusive, a thrifty, eco-friendly tradition hijacked into a rarefied luxury commodity, particularly now that vintage has been disrupted. The vintage marketplace used to be largely offline. Knowledge was gatekept, and sourcing required free time and a sense of adventure. It's gone supernova through a tech-led revolution in access, both to information and inventory, thanks to the flywheel forces of TikTok and Depop. With TikTok, every quiet thrift store became a viral hidden gem, and style became memeified by users who coined manias with ease. Gorpcore, Y2K, Indie Sleaze, Blokecore, Euphoriacore, Bob Dylancore, wearing a jacket that's not warm enough. London-based secondhand shopping platform Depop, which cleverly organizes its 30 million plus items around cores, became the one-stop vintage bazaar for any trend, no matter how transient or niche. All of these trends emerged not from runways, but from the near-infinite possibilities of the vintage marketplace. The wonderful thing about the secondhand market is, whether it's cottagecore or barbiecore or mermaidcore, millions of those items already exist, says Depop Chief Marketing Officer Peter Semple. Unlike traditional brands or retail stores, he says, we don't have to spot a trend and then manufacture to adhere to it. We just need to point people at the inventory that already exists. That way of thinking is inherent to the emerging generation of consumers. I have kids that come in here that embody all the cores, says 28-year-old Emma Rogue, owner of Lower East Side Shop, Rogue, which specializes in the grungy Y2K aesthetic she calls nostalgia core. The current shift to vintage is led by Zillennials, but is by no means confined to them. Veteran vintage dealer Tommy Dore owns a shop in suburban Detroit and a private showroom in Los Angeles. In Michigan, he saw his clientele change about 6 years ago from hipsters and alternative people to mainstream mall shoppers. It was around that time, Dore notes, that Kanye Ye West began wearing heavily patinated Carhartt jackets, giving the blue-collar staples a luxury veneer that transcended workwear, fashion, and streetwear. And that's where it really took off for people who didn't shop secondhand, Dore says. Of course, Ye's Carhartt shopping spree wasn't just to build out his blue-collar closet. It was part of his design research for Yeezy. Brands like Supreme, Fear of God, and Amy Leon Dore have massive vintage archives as references, which they spin into new garments. They were no doubt inspired by Ralph Lauren, whose collections have famously been guided by vintage mood boards. Everyone I work with, they shop vintage. It's so important, says Aaron Levin, the former designer of Abercrombie and Fitch, who now consults for brands like ALD and Madewell. Marcus Allen of NYC Vintage Showroom, the Society Archive, says his main client base is designers and design teams who hire him to source vintage mall brand clothes that inform everything from pocket shapes to entire seasonal looks. Emma Rogue, who stocks tons of archival Versace, was recently invited to the brand's runway show in Milan, which explains why, as vintage rises in visibility and desirability, the world of secondhand can look a lot like luxury fashion, sticker shock and all. As menswear commentator Derek Guy put it in a tweet, eBay and Grailed have totally skewed people's expectations for what they should get for used clothes. Thrashed clothes sell for 90% of retail price. Price inflation for coveted pieces has put them out of reach for the average deal-seeking shopper. We used to have drawers full of Gaultier mesh tops that we couldn't sell, recalls Weber. They now move for hundreds of dollars. Others are happy to pay luxury prices for clothes made before the age of mechanized, lower-quality clothing. If there's anything that deserves to be luxury, I guess it's vintage, right? Says Levin. It's special and unique, and it's hard to find. Will the vintage boom last? Semple of Depop sees fast fashion brands like Shine, which relies on a disturbingly algorithmic real-time retail production chain that can bring trendy new designs to market in days, as enemy number one. Shine shows up and can get things from ideation to shipping faster than anyone else ever has, he says. Dealers like Rogue complain that discarded fast fashion is now clogging the thrift stores and rag houses where they once scored much of their inventory. Heidi Bivens, the costume designer who put together the Euphoria high schoolers' vintage-filled closets, thinks the uniqueness and longevity of vintage will help it endure. There's always that allure of finding something where you know you're not going to show up at a party and someone's wearing the same thing, she says. And that feeling of ownership of a piece that maybe you'll have forever, even if it's subconscious, I think that young people do understand the power they have as consumers. Over at James Valoria, the vintage hype has hardly subsided. Last July, the founding duo opened a pop-up shop in L.A. The plan was to keep it open for 1 month. And then we did it, and it went so well, we were like, oh shit, says Weber. The pop-up stayed open through the fall, and on the day we spoke, he and his partner were putting the finishing touches on James Valoria, Los Angeles. This time, it will be permanent. So that concludes the introductory article, putting all the vintage hype and reality in context, and it's augmented with a series of coaching pieces. So here goes. My three grails. Parisian vintage dealer Gaultier Borsarello's personal inventory is loaded with highly covetable gems, from turn-of-the-century French chore coats to the rarest Nirvana tees. Here, the collector shows off three recent acquisitions that qualify as certified grails for someone who's seen it all. The 1940s hunting jacket. This super rare, reversible hunting jacket is a true American outdoors masterpiece. I had been after one for my vintage collection for a while. Then a friend told me to watch My Own Private Idaho. You're going to love the aesthetic, he said. And I see the jacket on River Phoenix in the movie. A few weeks later, the vintage gods are with me, and I get a message from an American dealer, Adam Canaston, from Bare Knuckle Boutique. He'd found one in great condition, and my size, $1,000. It was mine. The Umbro Soccer Smock. This soccer top gained legend status when Liam Gallagher snatched one from the locker of Main Road, Manchester United's old stadium, just before a live Oasis performance in April 1996. As he told NME, there was some player's fucking Umbro gear just sitting there, and I thought, I'm having a bit of that. Tried it on, fucking freebie in it, and I fucking pinched it. An original version is a grail for any Britpop fan, lad, or casual. I got this one through my friend Jojo at Rag Parade in Sheffield, UK. And the Hermès Haute au Courroie 50 centimeter. This is the first bag made by Hermès, originally designed to carry horse saddles and riding boots in the early 19th century. Serge Gainsbourg had one as a 48-hour travel bag. One day, Jane Birkin was on a flight from Paris to London next to Jean-Louis Dumas of the Hermès family and mentioned she needed a bigger women's bag. Dumas then designed a smaller version of the Haute au Courroie, the Birkin. My HAC is from 1991, with grained leather and brass hardware, just like Serge's. All right, here's a piece on a vintage purveyor, the Society Archive. Founder Marcus Allen. What's on the racks? An alluring mix of mall brand Americana that looks straight out of a GQ shoot, because some of it probably is. Allen is a leading collector of old Abercrombie and Fitch, which forms the backbone of an aesthetic of rugged elegance and casual luxury, as he puts it. I borrowed that from working at Abercrombie, he says. His teenage job at a shopping center outside Boston. Allen started collecting rare and unusual pieces of A&F history, much of which, it turns out, was as sturdy and well-made as the best vintage workwear. From his Water Street studio in New York City, he also hunts down old-school J. Crew rugbies, Gap button-downs, and Banana Republic safari jackets, while recasting beefy cargo shorts and logo-emblazoned polos as the aspirational and sexy, and yes, even luxurious, status symbols they once were. And here's a piece on vintage seller Intramural. The deepest end of the vintage clothing pool is filled with the rare, unexpected novelty and promotional goods that New York-based dealer Bijan Chavali, founder of Intramural, specializes in finding. Good luck topping these highlights from his collection, and you'll probably never see them anywhere else. The king of rare fashion merch. All right, the first piece featured is the Emporio Armani puzzle cube. Not sure when this is from. I imagine it's a gift with purchase from a department store deal, but I love how off-brand and unsexy it is for Armani. This is basically a Rubik's cube with colored Armani logo insignias on each block within the cube. Polo by Ralph Lauren X Rolex polo shirt. Viewed through a 2024 lens, where collabs between aspirational brands are common, this would obliterate the internet if it came to be today. And that's a polo shirt from Ralph Lauren with a Rolex logo on the chest. And now a ball cap, the Cafe Nordstrom hat. I saw this and was taken back to popping into Nordstrom with my mom as a kid. We'd grab a lemonade and a sandwich. It made shopping feel like a treat, not a chore. The 2002 Mercedes-Benz Fashion Week X Stephen Sprouse T-shirt. The Mercedes-Benz hit on the back and Sprouse's signature writing is the icing on the cake. And lastly, the Saks Fifth Avenue ashtray. I've come across many ceramic objects from Saks, which always have the logo stamped on, so this one stands out because it's hand-painted. Yes, the Saks Fifth Avenue ashtray. Dump your ash on the hand-painted flower and logo. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that Phoenix has a whole lot of really cool and well-curated vintage shops, but there's a ton of thrift shops too, and here comes a piece for us thrift store shoppers. How to win at the thrift store. Veteran inveterate thrifter Matthew Schnipper shares his secrets for bin digging, rack rifling success. Lots of Salvation Army stores have ended their Wednesday family days when the whole place gets discounted 50%. Goodwill has set up its own auction site of rare and high-end items, keeping the good stuff for itself. Point is, gone are the days of stumbling onto pristine band tees or 60s Levi's while thrifting. The key, then, is to go in with no expectations. Give yourself over to the journey, but while you're doing it, use some hard-won wisdom I've accrued from decades of haunting thrift shop racks. Number one, consider what could be. Find a great pair of corduroys with an inseam 14 inches too long, a classic Brooks Brothers button-down missing half its buttons. buy them and bring them to a tailor, the combined cost will probably be less than buying new. If you fall in love with something a little flawed, don't give up on it. Thrifting. It's just like life. Number two, thrifting is a gender-free zone. To a thrift shop employee, women's sometimes means smaller or has flowers on it. There's often no rhyme or reason to what goes where. Some shops are hip to this and are shelving garments together, but don't let a sign stop you from searching. 3. Skip the tees. One easy trick is to peruse shirts, sweatshirts, knits, and jackets just by looking out for a shoulder and sleeve as you walk the aisle. But flipping through racks of tees with their graphics hidden is a slog, with little chance of finding gold. You're better off hitting eBay or Depop for the one you really want. Number 4. A smell is forever. A washing machine is not a miracle worker. If it stinks in the store, it'll stink at home. Number 5. But a stain may not be. Some yellow around the collar or in the pits is not a shirt's death sentence. Thrifting means owning a tub of OxyClean and forming a close bond with your local dry cleaner. 6. The hard work is done in the dressing room. Pile anything remotely interesting in your cart. Then go through all your selects at the end, not while you shop. You'll be able to compare and get a better sense of what really hits. Number 7. This is a numbers game. Hit as many shops as you can. Sites like thethriftshopper.com list spots by zip code. If you find zilch in Patterson, Passaic is always around the corner. 8. Just take a photo. Do you go from zero to bitch in 2.2 seconds? Maybe. Do you need a shirt that says so? Probably not. Number 9. Get weird. Experiment with a low-cost beret, a silk shirt, shorter than usual shorts. If something outside your normal routine has a surprising allure, yield to it. Worst case, you can always redonate that sleeveless hoodie. Okay, that was good humored and good advice. Now we're on to defining GORP core, which I believe refers to granola and backpacking and mountaineering and all that good stuff. Explore the Golden Age of GORP core. Brian Davis of Vintage Shop, Wooden Sleepers, on the great early days of outdoors gear. From the late 60s into the 70s, a new wave of outdoor brands took over from the OGs, namely Eddie Bauer and L.L. Bean, that were less about alpine exploration, more about dropping peyote and climbing El Capitan and cutoffs. You've heard of the North Face, Patagonia, and Eastern Mountain Sports, but if you're deep diving for vintage GORP core, you'll also want to scout for underrated vintage gems from brands that don't exist anymore, like Camp 7, Class 5, Alpine Designs, Frostline, Alaska Sleeping Bag, Comfy, and Trailwise. Now get out there and enjoy the more rebellious version of the great American outdoors. And this article is augmented with photos of some pieces deemed special and has this following caption. This Eastern Mountain Sports Parka features the brand's super minimal first logo. I love the boxing glove pockets and nickel snaps on this Sierra Designs vest. A North Face brown label down jacket from the 70s, rare and timeless. This 80s L.L. Bean waist pack has two zip pockets to give your trail mix its own space. Camp 7 made some of the coolest, most obscure pieces of the era, like this puffer. The Rocky Mountain Featherbed brought Western rancher style to the down vest. A Holubar pack with beefy details like thick leather trim and nylon webbing straps. This faded Sierra Designs puffer nails the hippie backpacker vibe of the 70s. Okay, and now a piece as promised on buying a banging new suit. Or new to you suit. GQ style editor Yang Yi Go on how to buy high quality, pre-loved tailoring. The best cheap suit you can buy is an old one. Let's say you've got $1,000 for a new suit. First suit or 15th, for job interviews or a buddy's wedding, doesn't really matter. Where are you planning to spend the money? At the mall? Probably, where you'll get a perfectly fine mass-produced suit. But what if I said that for the same price, maybe less, you could get a better, more singular suit from a great tailoring house? That's the magic of vintage suiting. Shopping vintage is by no means an easier route to buying a suit. There are all the typical secondhand pitfalls to contend with, from spotty sizing to unmendable damage. You'll absolutely need to have your measurements on hand if you're trawling eBay, etc. But if you're willing to hunt a little, there are graceful 90s Armani joints and avant-garde 80s Comme des Garçons specimens for the taking, all at wallet-happy prices. And if you want something more traditional, a Tweety J. Press number, say, or a chalk-striped Savile Row affair, and happen to be in New York, then swing through Crowley Vintage in Brooklyn, helmed by former Ralph Lauren designer Sean Crowley. Crowley's advice for digging up suiting gold: go beyond the famous names like Ralph and Brioni. In the 20th century, there were so many quality tailored clothing makers, Crowley says. You look at a cheap suit made in America from 1975, the kind you would buy at JCPenney, and it's better than stuff that's made in Italy today. Okay, that's an intriguing point. May or may not be true, but it's his opinion, and now we're on to more. The All-Star Guide to Flea Market Mastery. Four of fashion's coolest designers took us to their favorite flea markets across the globe. And this article is by Max Berlinger. Ask the man behind Visvim, Hiroki Nakamura, what he loves about a flea market, and it's not only the chance to turn up a soulful grail or a century-old textile he can use in a new piece. What I'm looking for is a new perspective, he says. I'm not looking for particular things. With that in mind, we asked four designers from around the world to let us tag along while they dug through their favorite fleas, which happened to be four of the biggest and most beloved in existence. Okay, we'll begin with Emily Adams Bode Ajla at the Brimfield Antique Flea Market. Brimfield, Massachusetts, and it's open May, July, and September. And before we get into the body of this one, we must pause here for station identification. You're listening to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. And now back to our piece on Emily Adams Bode Ajla and the Brimfield Antique Flea Market. Emily Adams Bode Ajla grew up going to flea markets, but only started visiting the Brimfield Antique Flea Market when she started her label Bode in 2016. The sprawling thrice-yearly multi-day bazaar, running since 1959, is a Burning Man of mercantilism, packed with furniture, fabrics, clothes, and curiosities that tell a story. Bode, the brand, is informed by the types of textiles sold at these fleas, which embody self-sufficiency and an almost lost art of American craftsmanship. That means the designer is not always just there to stroll. Sometimes it's for pleasure, she says, and other times it's more intentional. There's a series of photos and some captions, and the captions contain advice. Funny things happen, especially at auctions. People don't know what they're getting until they unpack it. I tell people to ask where something came from, because often the seller knows a really wild story about the estate sale where they got it. Sometimes we have a really strict number and we pack up when we hit it. I think it's important to set a number and not go over it, even if it's just $100 more. Go when you want. Pack bags that are compactable. Layers are important. Wear sunscreen, because it's an open field, and keep in mind, there are only porta-potties or the woods. And thank you, Emily. We will remember that, especially the last bit. And now we're on to Hiroki Nakamura at the Toji Temple Flea Market, located in Kyoto, Japan. And it's open the 21st of the month. Hiroki Nakamura, founder of VizVim, is a historian of fashion, of fabrics, of people, who uses an anthropological eye and an artist's touch to make clothing that's been dubbed future vintage. His clothes can evoke the Japanese idea of wabi-sabi, a spiritual concept that finds beauty in imperfection and impermanence. It makes sense, then, that of the flea markets he frequents, his favorite is Kyoto's Toji Temple Flea Market, situated outside a five-story Buddhist pagoda. He goes to find porcelain, wood carvings, deadstock fabrics, and most importantly, vendors with a deep love for and stories about their various wares. "I want to see people who have their own eye and their own taste," he says. "That's interesting to me. People who do it not because of business, but because of passion." And again, there are informational captions. "I'll see something I like and ask myself, why do I like this? It has to be something I feel. When you design something, you have to use that part of your brain too, the feeling part versus the thinking part. I remember seeing this one guy about 18 years ago who was selling boro in Japanese indigo when people didn't care about it. It was just old workers' clothes. He was renting some rooms from the temple and living there. And I started using those ideas of boro and indigo for my line VizVim ICT. I'll bring a furoshiki, an old Japanese style of bag, which is basically a piece of cloth. If I don't have one, there's always one at the flea market." And now we're on to France. Pierre Maheo at the Saint-Ouen Flea Market. Paris, France. Saturdays, Sundays, and Mondays. Pierre Maheo, founder of the Officine Generale, vividly remembers his first time going to the infamous Saint-Ouen flea market some 35-plus years ago, when his big sister's then-boyfriend operated a booth there, selling vintage denim, leather coats, and Big E Levi's jackets. Since then, he's become something of a flea fanatic, traveling from Tokyo to Pasadena, but it's Saint-Ouen, one of the world's largest, with its 1,700 vendors spread across 17 acres, that he always comes back to. Maheo shops mostly for furniture to place in his stores. He says the clothing selection in the U.S. and Japan is better, and gets the people watching for free. On Sundays, it's a fun scene. You can see Hedy Slimane or Chris Van Asch walking by. Famous actors or singers, Maheo says. You can get coffee, lunch, and meet some friends. And amongst the captions you will find here, you'll see people with a nice look, how they wear their scarf or their vintage coat, the volume. It's inspiring. "We never go for the pieces that are perfectly restored because you lose the patina. It's why I hate dead stock. You want the patina. In our stores, the seating, lighting, and decor are vintage. I have their floor plans on my iPhone. When you look for something, you won't find it, and when you don't hunt, you'll find it. But that's part of the game." And I can tell you, folks, that I've certainly found that last bit to be true. Just go see what you see. You'll be happier that way. And now on to Pasadena. Chris Gibbs at the Rose Bowl Flea Market, Pasadena, California, second Sunday of the month. When Chris Gibbs, owner of LA Boutique Union, debuted his Air Jordan collab in 2018, he set up a booth at the Rose Bowl Flea Market and got to selling. "It was fun as hell," he says. "I had friends telling me they saw someone selling vintage Union Jordans that were fake, and I told them, no, it's real. Launched in 1968, the Bull goes down in a parking lot outside the Pasadena Stadium, with 20,000 shoppers showing up as early as 5 a.m., complete with headlamps, to get first dibs on the 2,500 vendors. You can find anything, but it's earned a global rap for street and sportswear from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and for its lively scene. And now we're on to the captions. I'm the kind of guy that will get there at like 10 a.m., not 5 a.m., but I'll spend the whole day there, like till 3 or 4 p.m. I'm probably the world's worst haggler. I shouldn't say that out loud. If I think it's worth $30 and they ask for $30, I'll pay it. I won't be like, well, can I get it for $20? I'm not going to the booths with piles of clothes. I want it more considered. But I also don't want it to be so considered that it's $1,000 t-shirts. If we can use it in terms of design, but it also fits me, I might spend more. I have an inappropriate amount of XL vintage in the Union collection. That was an honest admission. And now on to a brief feature piece on James Valoria, the store mentioned in the intro article. James Valoria founders are Brandon Valoria Giordano and Colin James Weber. What's on the racks? Flamboyantly going out tops and crazy pants from the most fun names of the 90s and aughts, like Vivian Westwood, Moschino, Comme des Garçons, and Jean-Paul Gaultier. The groovy and eccentric New York City shop, tucked away in the Chinatown Mall under the Manhattan Bridge, has long been discovered by TikTok, but it remains a beacon for the queer community, New York City transplants, and anyone who wants to get down in sexy vintage Versace. So many kids over the years have come to the store from all over the place just to feel comfortable dressing in whatever, says Giordano. Adds Weber, they moved to New York, and that's their first stop. Okay, this next one is an advisory piece, How to Tap into the Great Fashion Archives, and it's written by Gerald Ortiz. There's vintage, and then there's archive. The latter is what you wear when you have time, specific tastes, and most likely a deep bordering on obsessive love for the work of a great designer. If you're looking to get more serious than setting a couple eBay alerts, then maybe it's time you go collector mode. To get you started, we talked to four vintage dealers who specialize in knowing how to separate the drool-worthy grails from the diffusion line. In regard to buying Helmut Lang, buy denim suits and jackets. The expert advice is people always go for the obvious, like the bomber jacket with straps. And when in doubt, size up. And that's from Michael Cardamakis Endema. In regard to Yoji Yamamoto, buy pants, suits, and outerwear. The expert advice is start with Yoji's pants. They're good quality and fit nicely. Also, letter sizing is from the 90s, numbers from the 2000s. And that's courtesy of Etienne Bolduc, my clothing archive. Regarding Vivian Westwood pieces, buy early 90s menswear, gold label, 90s to the 10s. The advice is research. Explore what eras you gravitate toward. And that's from Johnny Valencia at Pechuga Vintage. And then in regard to Jean-Paul Gaultier, by mid-90s Mad Max collection, early aughts JPG by Jean-Paul Gaultier line. The advice is check the seller. If it's someone with one listing on eBay, it's suspect. And that's from Kyle Julian Sky at The Middleman Store. All right, thank you, GQ. And now we're on to What is American Style from Esquire. Getting dressed in the USA is all about how you see the world by Derek Guy. Back in the mid-90s, my friends and I spent a lot of time in nightclubs dancing to A Tribe Called Quest and Nas. The de facto uniform was baggy Maurice Malone jeans, stout Champion sweats, and anorak pullovers from preppy brands such as Tommy Hilfiger and Nautica. But the most stylish among us were Polo Ralph Lauren. Color-blocked sportswear met polo bare knits all over print shirts and choice items from the Stadium and P-Wing collections. Decades later, fashion writers described this aesthetic as a way for non-white youth to appropriate the status symbols of blue-blooded WASPs. And that's partly true. Ralph Lauren's polo logo is woven into the American image of financial success, and many of us simply wanted to stunt. But there's another story here about the thread that laces through the country's clothing history and the complicated, sometimes contradictory, essence of the American spirit. Despite its aspirational nature, American style is, at its core, a celebration of the everyday person. It's also, like all style, a form of visual language. Our outfits are not purely about creative expression. They allow us to communicate our identity, aspirations, and values. If you're a man getting dressed today, you're confronted with what can be an overwhelming array of choices and style mashups. Figuring out how to communicate within this cacophony can be disorienting. But the process of doing so is much easier when you understand the foundations of American style and how they shape some of the most inventive designers of the moment. If dress is a social language, then Brooks Brothers gave us our ABCs. The company introduced ready-made tailoring in 1849. Debuted its number one sack suit in 1901 and filled the American closets with tweed jackets and Shetland knits. Today, we think of this as old money style, and it makes sense as Brooks Brothers dressed upwardly mobile Americans who rose with industrial capitalism. But to understand what those clothes meant at the time, we have to jump across the pond to Britain. At the turn of the 20th century, British men in high positions, in trades such as finance and law, wore frock coats. Working-class clerks and administrators wore lounge suits, what we would consider a business suit today. Brooks Brothers' version of the lounge suit was even more democratic. Instead of being bespoke and hand-tailored, it was ready to wear and featured more machine work than its British counterpart, with a straighter, more utilitarian fit. The message was clear. Americans were outfitting themselves for a new social order, and they were recognizing the ordinary citizen by dressing down, not up. The impulse flourished over the next century. Americans helped popularize the two-piece suit and Oxford cloth button-down, more relaxed alternatives to the three-piece and starched spread collar. Ivy League students in the 50s and 60s wore sporty tweeds with country cords and penny loafers. Their working-class counterparts took to the five-pocket jeans, white T-shirts, and leather motorcycle jackets that Marlon Brando turned into a rebel pose. From the bell-bottom jeans and floral shirts of hippies to the repurposed utilitarian garments of punk and, of course, the creation of Western wear, every innovation pushed men's wardrobes toward the ever more casual. That spirit shines through in some of the most exciting American designers working today. At Amy Leon Dore, where guys will line up for a shot at a color-blocked rugby or a crew-neck sweater featuring a dog named Buddy, designer Teddy Santis has constructed a world around the youthful street culture of 1994 New York City. Fear of God founder Jerry Lorenzo makes an exceptional top coat, but he's built his brand on showing men how to dress it down with sweats and tracksuits. When Willie Chavarria debuted his collaboration with Dickies, he said he thinks the height of elegance is a clean, pressed pair of Dickie's pants worn with a crisp white t-shirt. The clothes in that collab exaggerate the proportions worn by working-class Chicanos in California, where Chavarria was born. Even Emily Bode, who has now won CFDA Menswear Designer of the Year twice, celebrates American design's thriftier elements. Jackets and pants with simple silhouettes are constructed with quilting, mending, and patchwork techniques that American women have used since the Revolutionary War. There are contradictions at play here. The brands we're talking about aren't cheap, and the preppy clothes that inform so much of American dress owe some of their allure to the implication of privilege born from inherited wealth. Even if the Kennedys weren't the Windsors, they were part of America's ruling class. But those contradictions are somehow even more American. This was the tension my friends and I played with when we wore the symbols of success to underground clubs, and it's the tension that runs through the history of American style, perhaps even into the future. And now to Esquire UK. Building blocks, the foundation of good style, statement staples that will outlive ephemeral trends, by Reese Smith. Oversized tailoring, harnesses, the Balenciaga Triple S. When you're in the grip of a good trend, nothing can convince you that it won't last. But inevitably, what goes up in cachet must come down, and paying too close attention to what's in vogue can start to feel like being on a very expensive, albeit thrilling, hamster wheel. Instead of endlessly chasing that buzz, it's far better to put your focus and hard-earned cash into pieces that will feel as fresh in 5 years as they do right now. This doesn't mean ignoring what's popular completely and living a life of tasteful drabness. Instead, it's about creating a solid foundation of style that you can build on in a variety of ways. The staples are the foundation of a modern man's wardrobe, says Mitch Hughes, who was appointed menswear director at M&S last year and is now working with the team on a push to become a genuine menswear challenger. Having invested heavily in understanding the M&S customer, the focus is to take the high street giant in a more confident contemporary direction, fueled by a distinctive new menswear campaign. The first for 8 years, which is bold, disruptive, and visually arresting. Hughes says that a good menswear staple transcends casual into smart and should work with items you already own. Basics that are more neutral in color are an obvious starting point because they can easily coordinate with prints, bolder shades, and more trend-driven styles. To increase the longevity of these pieces, I'd always recommend investing in styles made from classic quality fabrics with a premium aesthetic to really elevate your outfit, he adds. One example would be our Autograph Supima cotton t-shirt. It's superb value at £20, which is, back in the day, was about $30. One of the standouts of the autumn-winter 2023 M&S menswear collection is a simple two-piece suit with a slight Scandi feel. Cut in a deep green fabric, it's a welcome change from the predictable navy or blue. It's a subtle nod to the season's trends, but with a sort of minimalist feel that feels permanently contemporary and works for dress codes of all sorts. We chose this shade specifically as it feels understated, premium, and adaptable, Hughes explains. I've worn it myself with a tonal green merino, but it also works great with a black t-shirt. It's a really versatile suit that will transition with you for seasons to come. Another key staple in the collection is a workwear-inspired cardigan with a proper collar and two big pockets. Cardigans might be having a moment right now, but they never truly go away, such is their versatility. It's a style that's always existed within menswear, but now we're seeing more interesting fabrics, prints, and designs emerging, Hughes says. Sometimes it's about taking those evergreen pieces and wearing them in a different way. Knit layering is going to be a huge trend, particularly as we head into spring 2024, Hughes explains. The cardigan can be styled tonally, which looks great. It can be worn casually with a t-shirt or over a roll neck and jeans, or dressed up with a button-down shirt and pleated trouser. Mixing textures is another way to make a statement out of simpler styles, like wearing fine wool with chunky cord, or a cable knit with rugged denim and leather or suede boots. Footwear is hugely important, Hughes says. We've really elevated our offering this season. Team your knitwear with our white autograph leather trainer or a classic Chelsea boot. It's also worth broadening your idea of what makes a staple. A jacket might be a decent addition to the menswear canon, but its functional design means it's unlikely to go anywhere soon. It's a great seasonal staple, particularly with the ever-changing British climate, says Hughes. The new M&S Autumn collection features a particularly handsome jacket in understated check. My advice is to choose an accent color from the pattern and coordinate back to it tonally with layered separates, says Hughes. It's an easy way to pull an outfit together and achieve a look that's cool and considered. The ultimate goal, surely. And if any of this caught your attention or intrigued you, you can discover the new M&S menswear collection in stores nationwide or at MarksandSpencer.com, MarksandSpencer.com. And now we're back to GQ for a piece on denim by Samuel Hine. The blue-collar icon of American spirit is hitting new fashion heights, so we invited a righteously stylish crew to pull on the flyest jeans and vests, jackets and kimono chore coats of the season. Denim's new age. And I should mention that this article features people you may know from sports and fashion and other realms wearing denim, and some information about the denim and about what these folks are up to these days. And it begins with Dwayne Wade, Hall of Fame hooper and entrepreneur. D. Wade didn't slow down after hanging up his jersey in 2019. It's about trying to create the vision I have for myself, he says. And now he and his wife, Gabriella Union, run Proudly, a baby care line. Plus, he has a wine brand and a clothing label, and he just launched a podcast in January. He's also a Fashion Week regular. Donatella Versace is just DV to Wade. Before his GQ shoot, he woke up early for yoga. When I was an athlete, I was up before my competition, he says. Now, same thing. Vintage jeans. He's wearing Levi's from Front General Store. Daniel Moon and Company, colorist to the stars. Behind almost every celeb with a radical hair transformation is Daniel Moon, who wields dye, bleach, and brushes with the skill of an abstract painter. We're color shamans, says the 23-year salon guru who gave Kid Cudi a tennis ball do and popularized sherbet-colored hair in Hollywood. He and his stylish squad are still the best ambassadors for wavy hues. Moon's tip? Dress it up. Multicolor has a bad reputation for being too punky, he says, but I wear suits and ties. I love seeing it in a sophisticated way. And Daniel Moon is pictured wearing a vest and jeans from Givenchy, and he's surrounded by a number of women who are sporting denim from Diesel, Meow, Laura Piana, Fang Chang Wang, and Chrome Hearts. And there's an article within this article. The Beatles weren't particularly known for their blue jeans. The suits and boots and haircuts loom larger in the popular imagination, but they did contribute a few poetic lines to denim's rich cultural history. Ringo Starr shares with me one example in particular. When the Fab Four strolled across Abbey Road, Ringo, John, and a shoeless Paul wore suits, while George brought up the rear in a dark denim shirt and groovy flare jeans. The composition was impromptu. That's what we put on that day, the Beatles rhythm man says with a shrug. Paul looked like he was looking for a job, he says, laughing. But denim-clad George? George, he says, was just cool. What was true then is still true now. The perfect pair of blue jeans is the epitome of cool. It is a style and symbol that transcends time and all of the things that divide us. When it comes to denim, now we're all seeing eye to eye, says Hall of Fame hooper Dwayne Wade. She can rock it, he can rock it, they can rock it. Wade and Starr are two of more than 20 international denim aficionados GQ recently gathered together in a photo studio in Los Angeles. Everybody was asked to bring their own favorite jeans, and they brought plenty of their own stories, too, about the intense emotional connections we have to these workaday garments. Past Lives leading man Tao Yu recalls how as a German-born Korean kid living in Cologne, he was captivated by denim-filled spaghetti westerns on television. Talk about a cross-cultural mashup. In South Africa, denim is everything, says Amapiano pop star Tyla, who keenly understands denim's universal coming-of-age connection. I remember being young, I would beg my parents for 501s. Supermodel Winnie Harlow is from Toronto and has been rocking Canadian tuxedos for her entire life. I'm a denim enthusiast, she says. Turnstile bassist Franz Lyons enthusiastically destroys his denim. You get one fresh pair, you wear them until dust, and then you cop another one, he says, sporting a pair of patched-up denim double knees. I did almost all the repairs myself until 2 years ago, and then I needed somebody that was nice with a machine. Atlanta rap superstar Gunna tells me he's been trying his hand at making his own jeans. Why? His favorite pair of distressed designer denim went missing on a recent trip. I love those jeans, he says. I tried to find them. I tried to buy them again. I couldn't find them. So I was just like, I'm going to make me some jeans like them because they were fire. What else are you going to do? What else are you gonna do but say thank you to your stepson Tristan for inspiring this show, and thank you to all of you for listening out there. I'm your host, Robert Streit. You've been listening to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org, and a whole bunch of pieces on fashion, American fashion, the staples you need to build your wardrobe, and the effect of vintage on modern fashion. And all bunch of coaching on where to find vintage and how to get a hold of it. I will remind you that you can listen to the show again on Podcast On Demand here at SunSounds in case you missed any of those websites and leads. And I encourage you to do so, the show and others. Between now and next week, happy shopping to you. And to me, take care of yourself. Take care of one another. Peace.